You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Well, my grandpa fought in World War II, my uncle fought in Nam. My father was too young, he went to school and met my mom. And her dad always told us stories around dinner time. And there's one he told when I was young that sticks out in my mind. He said 10 years after daddy taught me about the birds and bees, I was stranded in Pearl Harbor fighting off the Japanese. When the kamikaze pilots came and dove in without warning, I was on the Arizona on a warm December morning. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older and it's happening again.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and that's Griffin House and his piece, I Remember It's Happening Again. Captain Paul K. Chappelle graduated from West Point in 2002 and was deployed to Baghdad during 2006 and 2007. He now serves as a commander of a Patriot battery at Fort Bliss, Texas. We talked with Captain Chappelle last year while he was writing his first book, which was published just this week on February 1st, entitled Will War Ever End? A Soldier's Version of Peace for the 21st Century. Today we welcome back Captain Paul Chappelle to talk about that book. Before we turn to Captain Chappelle, I'd like to welcome another of our guests, Robert Abdul Haydar. Welcome, and it's good to have you back on the show again.
Thank you, Susan.
You're an American convert to Islam, a translator of Persian literature, and author of Spy of the Heart, a memoir of the years you spent in Afghanistan in the 1980s. This week on Thursday, you'll be bringing these gifts and talents to an event at the Asian Art Museum, and I'm going to invite you to tell our listeners about that event and how they can attend.
Very well. This Thursday evening at the Asian Art Museum from 6 till 7:30 p.m., I'll be giving a talk called 1,000 Years of Sufi Literature, which is mainly literature from the Sufi tradition and mainly from the Persian, which is spoken not only in Iran, but in Afghanistan, throughout Afghanistan. And so the poets that I'll be reading from are mainly from that region. And this is in response to, you know, sort of having sold out the last lecture that was done during the Afghanistan exhibition. So they invited me back, but this is a whole new talk. And it will introduce people to the poetry itself and the beauty of that poetry, but also will be exploring the ideas and the sort of spiritual practices that are revealed in the poetry.
So you'll have other people reading also?
Yes, that's correct. There'll be a special guest whose name is Raz Muhammad Zareh, who is an Afghan poet, a Sufi poet, who is around 86 years old, who is a very lively fellow with some wonderful poetry from a book that we've recently published called Fragrant Blossoms from the Garden of Gnosis. And he'll be attending during the second half. So during the first half of the presentation, I'll be reading selections from the poets of that region and introducing people to that style of poetry. And then after the break, we will come back and we'll be on stage and I will be asking him questions about his poetry, but also he'll be reading it in his language and I'll be giving translations.
And so this is Thursday, February 12th at the Asian Art Museum.
Yes, and it's in the studio, the education studio, that's right next to the cafe. And so what you do is whoever wishes to go, they just come over to the museum, which is in San Francisco there, the Asian Art Museum, And after you enter, and by the way, that's at 200 Larkin Street in San Francisco, you come up to where the cafe is, and the particular lecture hall is just right next to the cafe to the right. And also let me say that there is limited seating, and so I recommend that people call the museum, and specifically, should I give the phone number?
Please do.
Yeah, so to call 415-581-3701. There will be an announcement first, and if the lecture is sold out, people will be notified of that. But if it doesn't say that it's sold out, they can leave a message of their own, and I recommend they give their name and phone number in case there were to be a problem. But that way they would reserve their seat in advance, so when they arrived and paid, they would be sure to have a seat there.
Sounds good. So that's Thursday, February 12th at 6 to 7:30. Robert Dar, I'm going to ask you to treat our listeners today to one of the poems that you will be sharing at the Asian Art Museum.
Okay, very good. This is a poem of Rumi's from the Masnavi, and this particular poem is about spiritual learning, which he says happens through poverty, meaning poverty of egotism, or sort of letting go of one's egotism, and what to do from there. And also, I'll let the reader know in advance that this poem is based on a Quranic verse about everyone having a kind of expansion in their breast or in their heart, just ready to be unfolded by the right circumstances or the right teaching. So here is this poem. Rumi says, "Learning knowledge takes place through words. Learning a craft occurs through its practice. If you want poverty, it depends on companionship. Neither will your tongue avail nor your hands. That special knowledge is gained soul to soul, not from a manual and not through words. Though secrets are held in the seeker's heart, there is not yet the knowing of those secrets until the expanding brings the heart radiance and God recites, have we not expanded? Within the breast we have given your opening. We have placed the expansion in your breast, but still you seek it outside of yourself. Why do you go to other dairymen for milk? There's an unfailing source of milk within you. Why do you still look for it in a pail? O lake, you have a channel to the sea. Have shame to want water from a puddle. Didn't we expand, not explained it to you? Why seek after openings and play the beggar? See the expanding of the heart within yourself, so as not to be faulted with. Do you not see?"
Sufi poetry is a unique form of poetry, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And the closest thing, really, that we could compare it to would be the mystical poetry from completely different cultures that make the same assumption about the human being. So if we were to look at the poetry of Zen Buddhism, for example, which regards the human being as a creature that is innately illuminated, but somehow asleep to that fact or veiled from that fact, Sufi poetry as well views the human being as already being in the presence of their own spirituality, but they're just not aware of it. So this particular poem that I just recited is referring to that, to this expansion in the spirit, which is occurring all the time, but a person is unaware of it.
Mm. And so the event will go on from 6 to 7:30, and we'll be hearing poems like this.
Yes. And we'll be hearing the ecstatic poetry of Hafez and the beautiful poetry of Saadi, more of Rumi, of course, and Shabastari, who, as you know, I've recently translated. And then, last but not least, is a living Sufi poet from Afghanistan, Raz Muhammad Zadeh.
Listeners, Thursday, February 12th, 6730, 200 Larkin Street, the Asian Art Museum.
All right. The only thing I wanted to give you is the specific number for this lecture, but it's 415-581-3701.
Thank you.
Susan, thank you so much.
It's my great pleasure to welcome back Captain Paul Chappelle. Welcome to Raising San Radio.
Oh, thank you, Susan.
Well, last year you were with us about this time, and you were just about finishing up your book, and I'm very happy to say that you're with us today to talk about that book. It is called Will War Ever End? A Soldier's Vision for Peace in the 21st Century. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
You're an active duty soldier. You're an active duty captain in the United States Army, and here you are writing a book about peace. How did that happen?
Well, that's a very good question, Susan. And I think deep down, most soldiers in the Army want world peace. And I can explain it in this way. If you look at how commercials recruit soldiers, if you look at how the Marine Corps or the Army or the Air Force or the Navy recruit their soldiers to serve, they either use slogans that refer back to defending our country, protecting our way of life, or they'll rely heavily on self-improvement, free money for college. And those are all very worthy reasons to join the military. And that is what the military uses to recruit people. Those ideals of selflessness, service, defending our way of life, defending our country, or personal improvement and making ourselves better as human beings. Of course, if you read Dave Grossman's book on killing, which is a very good book that I highly recommend, he says that 2% of the people in the military are psychopaths. So 2% of the people join the military because they want to kill somebody. But if you look at how recruiting is done, the majority of the people join the Army because they want to become better as a person, or they want to defend their country or protect their way of life. And if you look at World War II as one example, that is probably the instance where the military was bigger than it had ever been in U.S. history. The military was huge, and you had people joining the military. Recruitment was very high, and it was a very large army at that point in time. And the reason so many people joined the army was because we were attacked by Japan, and a lot of people wanted to stop Hitler. They wanted to stop Nazi Germany. And stopping Nazi Germany, which was a very aggressive country that was invading countries all over Europe and stopping Japan, the goal of that is world peace. A lot of soldiers joined the army because they wanted to stop Hitler. They wanted the world to be more peaceful. So warfare has changed a great deal in the past 50 years. And in our country, we have a lot to be proud of. We have a lot that's worth protecting. But the central question is, what's the best way to fight for what's worth protecting? I think that our country is worth fighting for, but is the best way to fight for our country with guns or with ideas, through violent means or through peaceful means? And if you look at Nazi Germany again, the best way to resolve a conflict like that is to prevent Nazi Germany from ever arising, to stop the conditions that allowed Hitler to come to power. And that can only be done peacefully. So if you look at Nazi Germany, think of it as a smallpox sore on your body. It's a symptom of a much deeper problem. And to prevent the smallpox sore, to prevent Nazi Germany from arising, you have to go much deeper into the root cause, the underlying problem. And to resolve the underlying problem, you can only do that peacefully. And violence is very limited in how effective it can be.
Well, let me back up here a second. I think you're right. So many young people do join the military because they want to do something that's worthwhile and meaningful in the world. But in some cases, and I know this because I was am a GI rights counselor, in some cases they find that the marketing has been too good, and they've discovered that the life in the military is quite different once they get there. What about the folks that feel like, man, I shouldn't really be here because I thought I was going to be helping people, but here I am learning to kill people.
Yes, I certainly understand that point of view. And when you watch Army commercials or Marine commercials or Air Force commercials, they never talk about killing anybody. It's all about teamwork, camaraderie, brotherhood, the few, the proud, the brave, be all you can be, getting money for college, developing job skills, defending your way of life, your parents being proud of you, protecting your country, but they never actually talk about you having to kill somebody. And it's, in a way, deceptive, because in the military, you have to kill people. And they don't market that aspect of the military. That's why I think so many people join the military for good reason, because they want to join to defend their country. They want to join to make themselves better, to protect their loved ones. But in On Killing, Dave Grossman says that he has a very powerful argument that human beings have an innate resistance to killing other human beings. That the act of killing is fundamentally unnatural. And so, for example, in World War II, less than 25% of the soldiers in combat fired their weapons at the enemy. But the Army learned from why soldiers weren't able to fire at the enemy. They developed new training techniques, and in Vietnam, that number was over 90%. So if human beings have an innate resistance to killing other human beings, and people are recruited to join the Army because they think that they're going to make themselves better, get free college money, defend their country, then they face the fact that they have to kill. I can see how it's a very, very difficult problem that most people have to face.
But you must run into that. Being a captain, you must, you know, run into the folks that are going, whoa, what am I doing here? And here you are in this interesting position of writing a book about peace. How do you deal with that person-to-person interaction in the military? Do they know that you've been writing this book?
Up until about a week ago, across the entire Army, maybe four or five people knew about this book. I've been working on it for 9 years, but I haven't really talked about it a great deal.
That's amazing. You've been there for 9 years and only four or five people knew?
Right. I've been working on it for 9 years. Other
wow.
people knew, but they've gotten out of the Army.
Uh-huh.
So about a week ago, maybe four or five people in the Army knew that this book was about to get published.
And were those officers?
Mostly officers, yes.
Hmm. Interesting. Talk about that.
The response I've gotten from people in the military who know about the book has actually been a very positive response, because there's a certain taboo behind killing. Killing is a very difficult thing to confront, and there's almost a taboo about not talking about it. And if you look at warfare, there's this myth going around that human beings are naturally violent, but I think it's far from the truth. And one small piece of evidence I can offer is war drives most people insane. Most people who go to war become psychologically traumatized, sometimes to a point where they can't recover. And war is probably the most traumatizing thing a human being can go through. So if war was so natural to our species, if we were so naturally violent, so naturally warlike, why would most people go to war and then go insane? Why would killing be so difficult? Why would, with no military training, most people not be able to kill? So it's important that we discuss war, violence, conflict. And Dave Grossman's book On Killing, even though he says that human beings have an innate resistance to killing other human beings, that the only way to kill another human being is to dehumanize them. And he talks about how in the past we would call the enemy krauts or japs or gooks in order to kill them, or we would create psychological distance through dehumanizing the enemy, or we would create mechanical distance. For example, it's much easier to drop a bomb on somebody than it is to shoot them with a rifle at 200 meters away. It's much easier to shoot someone at 200 meters away than it is to stab somebody with a knife at close range. So the closer you are to the person, the more guilt you'll feel. And of course you have the 2% who are psychopaths. And I'm surprised in our country, if you look at our culture, how violent our media is, how violent television is, how violent video games are, movies, the kind of role models children have, I'm surprised that more than 2% of people in our culture aren't psychopaths.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually quite surprised by that.
Actually, I'm going to interrupt you here for a second because this is kind of one of my pet peeves. I think the culture is really very militaristic, partly, I mean, you've just described how, from the movies, from all the kinds of entertainment we see, and yet that doesn't seem to be something that most people are conscious of.
The media turns war into almost a fairy tale. They never show the consequences of war. Sometimes they do. If you watch a movie like Born on the 4th of July, that movie more accurately portrays the aftermath of war. But if you grow up watching G.I. Joe and watching Transformers and watching a lot of these glorified movies, they don't really create an accurate depiction of war. And if you play video games, I grew up playing video games, so I can speak from personal experience, the depiction of war is very, very inaccurate and doesn't do justice to the trauma that people go through. And that can be very dangerous when we have a conception of the most traumatizing thing a human being can experience and that being glorified in a very unrealistic way.
And yet, as you say, when you get into the military, there's these taboos about talking about certain things, the central point being there's a taboo about killing.
Right.
Tell me about the process of learning that that's your role in this career.
Well, thankfully, a book like On Killing was written.
Let's just tell our listeners that we're talking about Lieutenant Dave Grossman's book, On Killing, The Psychological Costs of Learning to Kill in War and Society. Very important book. It's important to say, and you have Lieutenant Colonel Grossman's foreword in your book, so congratulations on that, too.
Thank you for reminding people about his book. His book is a very valuable tool for the military, and On Killing is used as required reading in peace studies program at Berkeley. It's used as required reading in Quaker Mennonite colleges, but On Killing is also on the FBI Academy's required reading list. It's also on the U.S. Marine Corps Commandant's required reading list. It's also required reading at West Point. And by having a tool like that, you can open up discussion about what a soldier has to do in combat, which is never marketed in television commercials. I have yet to see an Army, Air Force, Navy, or Marine commercial where they emphasize the fact that you have to kill in combat. And there's other tools, too. There's a really good documentary they're showing at West Point now called Soldiers of Conscience, where the director, Gary Weinberg, he takes several soldiers who disagree with killing, several soldiers who have been able to justify the fact that they have killed, and it's a very good way to open up discussion about this very difficult subject. And I think that most people don't realize how difficult of a subject it can be. Because if you play video games, you watch television, you watch movies, killing is done effortlessly. If you watch an action movie, the hero of the movie kills 50, 100, 500 people and doesn't have any problem with it, feels no remorse, and it's just a very unrealistic depiction of what happens in war.
My impression of how you were trained to kill was that it was much more overt, that all of this was much more overt. But then I discovered there's a postcard of West Point with a class of young men reading the poem Howl, Allen Ginsberg poem Howl. And I've subsequently began, talked with other people that have taught there and have been students there, and have discovered that the education is really very classic. You really try and get people to think critically, sort of the opposite of what my stereotype was. And I'm hearing you say the same thing here. So what's going on is we, the civilians, don't really understand how war is portrayed by the actual military. Can you help us understand that?
Yeah, that's a very good point you brought up, because the military is more than just about killing. What the military really tries to emphasize is camaraderie, brotherhood, teamwork, selfless service, sacrifice, empathy, soldier care, compassion. That's what makes a military unit strong. The ideal of you never leave a fallen comrade. No matter if the person's hurt, even if they're dead, if they're in trouble, you never leave a fallen comrade. You never leave somebody behind. You go back for everybody. You take care of everybody, and that's what makes you strong. You care for each other. You fight to protect the person to your left and to your right. And a lot of people like that about the military because in our society, we're missing that. If you look at a lot of other cultures, they have a very heavy reliance on close family, extended family, community. And in the military, you get that sense of community that a lot of people don't get in American society. But I really like the fact that you brought up West Point because the education at West Point is not what most people expect. For example, you have to take a class on poetry, you have to take a class on essay writing, you have to take a class in philosophy, political science, you take chemistry, physics, calculus, you have to get an engineering minor. When I was there, you had every cadet at West Point had to minor in engineering. And it's a very diverse classical education.
Hmm.
You also have to take swimming, you have to take boxing, and you have to take gymnastics, all mandatory classes.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, they aren't aware of the fact that poetry, that at West Point you have to take a mandatory poetry class, gymnastics, physics, chemistry, calculus, a very diverse program.
Mm-hmm. It sounds much more like what I would think of a classical European education, but the general education in this country is not that way at all. So there's a huge gap between those two worlds, again, the military world and the civilian world, even in education.
I think there's a lot of misunderstanding between the civilian world and the military world because there's no longer a draft. And a lot of people don't know anyone in the military. And in that kind of situation, stereotypes are always going to rule. Unless you know somebody who's in the military, or enough people in the military to get a good idea of how most people are, stereotypes will ultimately prevail.
Well, let's talk more about these misunderstandings between the two worlds, because in my world, having done a fair amount of anti-war work, when the troops started returning from these wars now, I very quickly realized that we anti-war activists were very much out of tune with where these young people were, and that unless we understood more about how they were thinking and, you know, how they were trained, we were not going to be effective at all. I think it's really important that we do understand more about one another so that we on the anti-war side have fewer assumptions, unconscious assumptions, and that it's also true about people in the military. So I really want us to concentrate a little more on this today, if that's okay with you.
There's a really good quote from MacArthur, General MacArthur, who said that the soldier above all other people prays for peace, for he must bear and suffer the deepest wounds and scars of war. And I think that quote is very accurate. A lot of people in the Army, they want peace. And if you look at a war, soldiers are the ones who suffer the most, more than anybody. In Dave Grossman's book on killing, he says that the most traumatic experience in war is killing another human being. And he has a lot of research. He says if you look at the trauma of the citizens who survived the London bombings during World War II, they don't have nearly as much psychological trauma as the soldiers of Vietnam who had to kill men, women, and children at close range where they could see the faces of their victims. Granted, civilians also suffer a great deal as a result of war. That's another reason why war has to end. Soldiers suffer a great deal. Soldiers' families suffer a great deal. And the majority of people who suffer in war are civilians. For every enemy combatant you kill, you end up probably killing multiple civilians, especially when bombing campaigns. So the approach I use is giving soldiers a different alternative. Warfare has changed so greatly in the past 50 years, and one thing we learned at West Point was that the very fundamental nature of warfare has changed in the 21st century. The use of military force and violence is very limited and very unreliable. And at West Point, we have such diverse education because they say in the future we're going to have to rely more on diplomacy, more on different functions of creating a stable world. And that's why we have to take international relations, political science, and that's why the military has changed its structure. The military is relying a lot more on civil affairs and winning hearts and minds and trying to confront these problems in a new way. But right now, it's just not working. The military is too small, and I think a lot of people haven't really grasped how warfare and the world has changed. And how violence really is not nearly as effective as it was 50 years ago. And perhaps it was never that effective to begin with.
Paul, to come back to the trauma of war, do you think some of the trauma that we're seeing these days, and we agree that there's a lot more than we're actually hearing about, is because of this kind of split between what people believe they're going in to do and then what they end up doing, and they come back here and there's that split continues because of the, let me call it, the ignorance that one side has of the other, the military, the civilian world?
There's a lot of reasons that trauma occurs. War itself is fundamentally traumatizing, and I think the approach I take is much different than the approach used by a lot of people in the peace movement. The approach I'm using is that if you want to understand health, if you want to understand human health, you have to understand disease and illness. In the same way, if you want to understand peace, if you truly want to understand peace, you have to understand war in a much deeper way. And what led me to believe that world peace is possible, very, very practical and necessary, was learning about war. The more I learned about war, when I deployed to Baghdad in 2006 and 2007, when I studied military history at West Point, serving in the Army, the more I learned about warfare, the more certain I became that war could end and that world peace is possible. I look at war as an illness, something that can be cured, something that can be healed. And all these wars we've been having throughout history, they're symptoms of a much deeper problem, like smallpox sores. But I want to get to the underlying root, underlying psychological reasons why war occurs. Mm-hmm. And after everything I learned, I'm more certain than ever that war can end in the 21st century.
What about those people who claim that if the soldiers simply refused to fight, war would stop?
That's a very good question, and I hear that question a lot. But it's no longer true, and I can explain why. If you look at how our founding fathers structured our government and the military, they made the military completely subservient to civilian authority. So that's why the highest general in the Army is subservient to the president, who's subservient to the American people. Because the founding fathers understood world history. They knew that military dictators have a tendency to overthrow democratic governments. That doesn't always happen. For example, George Washington had the chance to be a military dictator when he gave back power to the people. Cincinnatus had the ability to have been a military dictator, but he gave power back to the people, and he became a farmer. But then you have Napoleon, you have Julius Caesar, you have all sorts of coups throughout the past century and throughout world history. And the founding fathers realized that it's just too much of a temptation to give one man the opportunity to overthrow the government. So a lot of people say that the reason you can't criticize the president when you're in the military is because the government wants you to shut up. But that's not the real reason. The reason that the founding fathers said that soldiers can't criticize the president is because they were worried about soldiers arguing for a war. They didn't imagine a situation where the civilians want to go to war and the soldiers don't want to go to war. They were imagining soldiers being the instigators based off Julius Caesar and people who had done that in the past. So, for example, MacArthur opposed Truman and said that we should drop nuclear weapons on China, and Truman's wrong, and Truman relieved MacArthur. And the last thing we would want is for the president to say, it's time to leave Iraq, and all the generals stand up and say, no, he's wrong, we have to stay in Iraq. Or the president says, let's leave Afghanistan, and the generals say, no, we have to stay in Afghanistan. Or the president says, we're not going to attack Iran, and the generals say, no, we have to attack Iran. So that's what the founding fathers were worried about. They were worried about soldiers disobeying civilian authority. That's why we had this very unique and remarkable system. But warfare has changed now. The military has become much more privatized. In the past 15 years, private contractors have become the norm overseas. We have more private military contractors, civilians in Iraq, than we have American soldiers. If you look at Blackwater, all these corporate armies, as the military diminishes in size, the private contractors increase in size. You have more corporate armies. You didn't have companies like Blackwater during World War II. And so if soldiers refuse to fight, if the military is downsized, and civilian authorities still has a need to go to war, they'll employ civilians to go to war. Mm-hmm. We've seen that in Iraq.
That's a good point.
Oh, and just to finish that thought, there might be a day where people say, I mean, hopefully this never happens, but it's a dangerous trend. There might be a day in the future where people say, do you remember the good old days when the military was subservient to civilian authority, and now the military is owned by a bunch of corporations that can just do whatever they want, and they really have no checks and balances to keep them under control? And it's a very dangerous precedent, what's happening with corporate armies. What has to change is the civilian authority. The president is subservient to the American people. The American people, the president, the Congress, they decide whether or not we go to war. If the president wants to go to war and soldiers refuse, he'll simply increase the size of Blackwater, corporate armies, civilian contractors, mm-hmm. as they've done over the past 8 years.
In fact, what we've seen over the past 8 years was not so much the military that was itching to get to war, but the civilian side of it was itching to go to war.
Yes, and it's very dangerous because, just to go back to private contractors and to also address that point, when private contractors die in combat, nobody counts their casualties. So the big argument about bringing the troops home from Iraq is over 4,000 American soldiers have been killed, but nobody counts the deceased contractors. also contractors are cheaper to send overseas than soldiers in the Army. So they're not only cheaper from an economic standpoint, but there's not as much social unrest amongst the American public when contractors are killed versus when soldiers are killed. So it's much easier to go to war if you rely on contractors than soldiers, because you don't get as much opposition from the American public.
Right, and you can also get those contractors from all over the world, which is what we do. Let me remind our listeners that we're talking with Captain Paul Chappelle. His book, Will War Ever End? A Soldier's Vision of Peace for the 21st Century. I also want to add that Paul Chappelle has very generously donated a number of these books to Motherspeak, our partner, Motherspeak. And you can go to our website, www.motherspeak.org, and learn more about how you can get one of these books.
I didn't address the question you asked. I apologize. You talked about how the war rhetoric comes from civilians primarily?
Well, in the war that we're engaged in right now, what we saw was the military being less enthusiastic about going to war with the way the civilians had set it up. You know, the lean and mean military, as opposed to the military officers saying, "Look, we need a much larger force if we're going to do this." And the civilians really had the say in how things worked, which is the opposite of what you were getting at, if soldiers simply refuse to fight.
No, that's a very good point. Civilians, they'll make the war. If they really want it to happen, they'll make it happen, unless the American public stands up to it. And what I'm trying to get at is a lot of people put all the emphasis on soldiers. But the way our government and our country was designed is soldiers are supposed to have the least amount of power in our system. The people who are supposed to have the most power are the American citizens. They control the country. They're supposed to. Below them is the president and the Congress, and below them are the soldiers. And so it's really up to the American people to make war not happen. And when we invaded Iraq several years ago, the military was very small. So we relied upon civilian contractors. That's why we have more contractors in Iraq than we have soldiers. And they invaded anyway with a very small military, even though General Shinseki said the military is too small. Mm-hmm. It's not going to work. So we have to put the emphasis on what the American citizens do and them being more involved and more active, and them realizing that they are the ultimate decision makers if they embrace their duties as American citizens.
If they do. You're also involved with Generation We, and you have some information on that on your website, which is www.paulkchappelle.com.
It's C-H-A-P-P-E-L-L.
C-H-A-P-P-E-L-L.com. You have on there a multimedia piece, a video piece on Generation We. I would like you to talk about Generation We and how you see yourself being part of that generation.
Well, Generation We is a very interesting phenomenon. It's people who were born from, I believe, 1978 to the year 2000, give or take a year or two. And I was born in 1980. I'm 28 years old, so I fall within Generation We. But Generation We is a very interesting demographic with a lot of potential to make the world much better and much more peaceful. Generation We is more globally oriented. We are less politically partisan. We're more ethnically diverse. For example, I'm part African-American, part Asian, part white. And Generation We, as a whole, is more concerned about the environment, more peace-loving, and more hopeful, much more optimistic about the future. But there's also another side to that coin. Generation We is the first generation in American history to inherit a country in decline, a country that is faced with environmental problems, significant environmental problems, global conflict, quote-unquote war on terrorism, and enormous debt that we're just inheriting. And the potential is that Generation We can solve these problems. But right now, I'm 28, and I'm one of the older people in my generation. My generation is still very young. A lot of my generation is still in elementary school, middle school, high school, and we haven't really matured yet to grab the reins and fix these problems. But the problems are only going to become more significant in the next few years, and by the time it's our responsibility to take care of them, it's going to be a big challenge. But I think it's a challenge we can overcome. I'm very confident that we can overcome these problems.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to what I said earlier, the reason I'm so confident we can end war and have world peace is the more I learned about war, the more I studied it, the more confident I became that war could end. and we could solve these problems.
So how do you see the military's role in the 21st century?
The military's role is going to have to change. The military is too small, and the U.S. government is relying too heavily upon civilian or corporate armies, basically. And one thing I learned about West Point is the future of warfare is people have to understand the limitations of military force. In our culture, we've been taught that military force solves everything. The Gulf War, we invade Iraq, and everything's solved. But it didn't really solve those problems, which is one reason why we're back there. And if you look at the Civil War, we're taught, oh, we went through the Civil War, we freed the slaves, but African Americans in this country really didn't get their fundamental human rights until the 1950s and 1960s as a result of a peaceful movement. So yes, the slaves were freed, but war never fully solved the problem. It never fully resolved any problem in history. You always need peaceful actions to fully resolve a problem, as Martin Luther King Jr. did in the Civil Rights era. And we have to rely more on diplomacy, and we have to understand the limitations of military force. But if you watch movies or television, or you listen to a lot of the rhetoric from the media, you think, well, there's a problem, let's just send more troops, invade the country, all will be well. But it doesn't work out like that. And I think that people know so little about military history, that's why they think that military force is so effective. But the more you study military history, the more you realize that military force has severe limitations and often causes more problems than it solves.
So the gap, though, is how to, number one, get civilians engaged in their country again, and number two, how to get them to recognize how empowered they actually are. And right now it seems as though people are focused elsewhere. For example, the economy is so bad at this point. But what we're really talking about here is reintroducing civil empowerment.
Right. And that's a very good point you brought up, because I think a lot of people think it's hopeless. A lot of people say, well, the American public, they just have a lot of apathy. They don't care. You can't encourage people to get involved. It's just a lost cause. But I was listening to Noam Chomsky speak one time, and he brought up a really good point. He said that there's all these studies that have been done, and these studies show that it's not true that the American public is apathetic. The truth is that the American public feels helpless. So the reason that people don't vote, the reason that people aren't involved, is because they don't feel like they can make a difference. They don't feel like their vote counts. They don't feel like they can do any good. But if people feel empowered, if they feel like they have a voice, if they feel like what they say matters, that they can make a difference, they will be involved. So the reason so many people in the American public are disengaged is not because of apathy. It's because they feel helpless. They don't know what they can do. They don't know if what they do will even make a difference. But if you can show people this is how we can make a difference, there are peaceful ways and very effective ways to make a difference. For example, Martin Luther King's movement is just one example of all the tactics and techniques we can use to peacefully make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
If you show people that they can make a difference, if you show them that peace is possible, they will be more engaged. And we've seen that throughout history.
We actually just saw that recently with the Obama election.
It was a huge, unprecedented turnout. So people aren't apathetic. They're helpless. They feel helpless. That's why they don't care. But they will care if you give them, not everybody, but most people, most human beings, they want to make a difference. They want to be heard. Most human beings, they want to have an impact on their surroundings. Most human beings want to leave the world better than the way they found it. And those people are the people that we can reach and the people we can empower through giving them options.
Captain Paul Chappelle, I want to invite you to tell our listeners whatever it is you would like them to know about what brought you to this place.
I've been obsessed with the problem of war for most of my life. My father served in the Korean and Vietnam Wars, and my mother, she grew up in Japan during World War II, and she lived in Korea during the Korean War. And I saw how war had traumatized my parents and devastated my family. I was an only child growing up in Alabama, and since I was young, I've been obsessed with trying to understand whether or not war will ever end. But to answer that question, I realized that I had to ask and answer much deeper questions, such as, are human beings naturally violent and naturally peaceful? Is war an inescapable part of human nature? Only by answering those fundamental questions can we know whether war can end. And I think I've been able to answer those questions in this book. A lot of people think those questions are unanswerable, but I think that we can answer them in a very convincing way. And I think it's very good news. I think the answers provide a lot of hope for the future and a lot of useful ways of making a difference. So my concern with ending war is that war now threatens human survival. 100 years ago, we were developing automatic machine guns. Today, we have enough nuclear weapons to destroy the planet several times over, and technology is going to continue to evolve exponentially. You can't stop human innovation. So we can use our ingenuity to cure cancer, have safe forms of energy, or we can use our genius to make more and more destructive weapons. It depends upon our attitude. So war, it threatens human survival, and we have to end it, otherwise mankind won't survive.
Paul, what I find, and I've done a lot of anti-war work in the last few years, what I find is that we people, and not just people on the right, people on the left and progressives, we're very stuck in our way of thinking. We're sure we're right. We're sure that what we're going to do is going to change the way the world works. And it's very difficult to ask the hard questions because you're considered to be less than completely left or, you know, whatever. There's always some reason not to answer the hard questions and to be discouraged from asking them. What do you say about that?
A lot of anti-war people I've met, a lot of them have very good intentions and they mean well. But I've met some anti-war people that see the world as black and white and they oversimplify the problem. And they want to believe that the military is the root cause of all evil in the world. And the simple solution for ending war is soldiers don't fight and war is done with. But it's not that simple. The problem of war is much more complex. And by understanding the real underlying nature of war, that makes it possible to solve the problem. Oversimplifying the problem does not empower you to stop it. But understanding that the world is not black and white, that there's a lot of gray, and the military is not what most people think it is. A lot of people have a stereotype of the military, but if you look beyond that stereotype, you can begin to see how we can actually end war. And a lot of people in the Army want an end to war. They want peace. Mm-hmm. A lot of people join the Army because they wanted to fight for a better world. A lot of people join the Army in World War II, for example, because they wanted to stop Nazi Germany. They wanted to stop fascism. They wanted to stop Imperial Japan. And they wanted world peace. That black and white conception, it doesn't help us solve our problem, mm-hmm. and it can also make it where it's harder for us to dialogue.
It is. It sort of shuts down the conversation. There's nothing more to say. Paul Chappell, what are your plans? Are you going to stay in the military? Are you going to be out? Where are you heading?
Well, right now I plan on getting out of the Army sometime soon. One primary reason, and there's a few reasons, but one primary reason is the amount of time writing takes. It's very difficult to juggle writing and my duties in the Army, which is a very demanding job. Also, at West Point, I learned the importance of service to your country and how it's also important to serve your country as a civilian. West Point teaches that if you get out of the Army, you also have a duty to serve your country, make your country better, through whatever means possible. And I think the problems right now are so severe, I think I have to provide greater focus on solving some of these deeper problems that I can do through writing, through spreading new ideas, through trying to open up dialogue with people, and mm-hmm. through taking peaceful action. So I plan on getting out of the Army.
And we plan on keeping you as part of our community here at Raising Sand Radio.
I hope that this discussion breaks some stereotypes, and I hope it opens up dialogue. If we can't dialogue with each other and talk about these things, that people in the peace movement aren't willing to talk to people in the Army, there's just really not much hope.
Mm-hmm.
That lack of dialogue is what leads to our most severe problems as human beings, is that unwillingness to communicate with each other, to find out where the other person is coming from. If you look at Gandhi and Martin Luther King, they dialogued with people who wanted to kill them. Martin Luther King was dialoguing with people who wanted him dead because he realized that that's the only way to solve these problems. The only way to solve these problems is to clear up the misunderstanding, to go to the underlying root, to change how people think for the better. I think the problems are so severe now, it'll require more time for me to try to do as much as I can to improve this problem. And I wouldn't be trying to solve these problems if I think they couldn't be fixed. I'm very hopeful for the future. And I think there's a lot that everybody can do if they're just given the proper guidance and direction.
Paul, I want to thank you for being with us. And if people want to get in touch with you, they can do so through your website?
Right, that's correct. And I have some essays on there, too. I have an essay about the nature of human aggression that I think people will find very useful and helpful.
So again, that's paulkchappell.com. You can get in touch with Paul through there. And I want you to stay in touch with us, and we will continue this conversation because I think the book that you've written, Will War Ever End? A Soldier's Vision of Peace for the 21st Century, is at least a very good starting point for the discussion that you're trying to encourage.
It's a first step, and it answers some very fundamental questions. It opens up new opportunities for making the world better. And I think people will find the book very uplifting, and I also hope very useful.
And again, they can get it. You have donated a number of books to MotherSpeak, www.motherspeak.org. Can order it through there. So thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, Susan. Thank you very much for having me.
I really appreciate it. It was great to have you. That was Captain Paul Chappell, the commander of a Patriot battery at Fort Bliss, Texas, and recently published author. Paul Chappell, as I mentioned, made a generous offer of this book to MotherSpeak, and you can purchase Will War Ever End? A Soldier's Version of Peace for the 21st Century, and benefit MotherSpeak at the same time as you benefit your home library with this unique view of war by an active duty Army officer. Go to MotherSpeak's website, www.motherspeak.org, or Raising Sand's website, raisingsandradio.org, to find out how you can order this book. The book also has a foreword by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, author of the classic book On Killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society. A reminder about Robert Abdul Haydar at the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco, 200 Larkin Street, this coming Thursday, February 12th, to enjoy an evening of poetry. The event, 1,000 Years of Sufi Literature, runs from 6 to 7:30 in the museum's education studio. Call before you go to ensure that there are still seats as these events fill up very quickly. That's our show for today. As usual, opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Tune in next week from 2 to 3 for a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Deborah Nelson about her new book, The War Behind Me, Vietnam Veterans Confront the Truth About U.S. War Crimes. As usual, all shows are available archived on our website, www.raisingsandradio.org. Thanks for listening.
Well, my grandpa fought in World War II. My uncle fought in Nam. My father was too young. He went to school and met my mom. And her dad always told us stories around dinner time. And there's one he told when I was young that sticks out in my mind. He said 10 years after Daddy taught me about the birds and bees, I was stranded in Pearl Harbor fighting off the Japanese. When the kamikaze pilots came and dove in without warning, I was on the Arizona on a warm December morning. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older and it's happening again. It was hard to have forgiveness for the things they did that day. And our president decided we should make their people pay. So we dropped on Nagasaki and we cut them down to size. And the one we dropped on Hiroshima left them vaporized. And I heard some Christians saying, what would Jesus do? What if you were on the wrong side? Would he point the gun at you? And they read through every word of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, so they could see if killing was the side that Christ was on. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older, and it's happening again. And they separate the church and state and keep God out of schools so our governments can educate based upon their rules. But people start to wonder if our politics makes sense when religion is our best excuse for national defense. And when our citizens start saying that our wars are not okay, and Washington keeps telling them God loves the USA, and they teach us history so we can learn from our mistakes, and this generation wants to know how many years it takes to change the way we treat our neighbors all across the land. Cause if we don't change our hearts, we repeat the past again. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now we're older, and it's happening again. My grandpa finished talking, we went walking, he and I. I was thinking of the future and how scared I was to die. Now my best friend's overseas, in the desert where it's dry, fighting for our country, and I need a reason why. I remember when he was a younger man, now he's a soldier fighting in a foreign land. Now we're all